Good morning. I'm sorry I wasn't here to hear all of the other talks. I was double booked this morning with talks. So I am going to start with some of the basics of ecological site terminology and theory as we use it in NRCS, and then I'm going to talk about how we might be able to apply some of those things to highly disturbed systems and particularly cropping systems. Just a brief slide on how this has gone in NRCS. In 1997, the ecological site concept was introduced into our manuals, primarily the National Range and Pasture Handbook, and the acceptance was slow, and it was very highly varied state by state. So in 2009, our chief at the time approved a decision memo to essentially try to standardize the use of ecological sites, accelerate the development, and it was a joint effort between various stovepipes in our agency, and they did develop or create a team in the Soil Survey Division called Soil Quality and Ecosystems. I'm the leader of that team. Sky is a integral member of the team. And so let's go on to the actual definition. And this is from the Interagency Ecological Site Handbook for Rangeland, but this should apply to forest as well. So it's a conceptual division of the landscape, and it's they define it in a paragraph. I broke it out into bullets based on the three main points. So it's an ecological site is found on a recurring soil, landform, geology, and climate. It differs from other kinds of land in its ability to produce distinctive kinds and amounts of vegetation. And then it is distinctive also in its ability or its response to management disturbance or other natural disturbances. You can see across the landscape, looking at the geomorphology and also looking at soils and the plants, that in certain landscapes it's quite obvious that they're very different ecological sites. I'd agree with Patrick on the East Coast there. It may have all secondary succession until you get invasive species, which is one of the management disturbances listed here on this slide. Other typical disturbances would be herbivory, fire, drought, flooding, and then cropping systems in there. One of the main things that are used in ecological sites for conservation planning is a state and transition model. And you can think about it as a state as a resistant and resilient complex of vegetation and soils it is cohesive, and the interactions determine the functional status of that site. And this is called a ball and cup model. It's not what's typically used now. It's one of the earlier ways that states were shown visually, graphically. One of the other very important things about states and transitions are those transitions. Between states, it's hypothesized that there's some threshold beyond which you can't go back to the state without significant inputs. And often it's hypothesized that it's some kind of a soil property, and that has not been tested very frequently. Often it's observed that they see erosions, and it's moved into a different plant community, ergo it's a different state. The transition is just the trajectory of change between states. Are you going from state 1 to 2 or 2 to 1, that sort of thing. And here's a theoretical, fairly complex state and transition model showing transitions. Transition and restoration sort of implies the value judgment with the reference state as well, and I'm not sure I'm quite on board with that. And the whole pre-European, is that really why we want, what we want to manage for? I think, maybe what we want to do is, the attainable state, because sometimes the pre-European state isn't quite possible, but that's a different talk. But the idea is that there is, at this point, a reference state, and then deviations from it and the pathways of how you get from it. And as Patrick was saying, within a state, there are community phases, and those are the smaller boxes within the larger boxes that you can see here, here, so on. So here's an example of a fairly simple state and transition model. Typically, the transitions in the narrative should be talking about processes. This isn't necessarily perfect, but it fits on a slide pretty reasonably, and just shows the difference between the reference state, which is the post oak flowering dogwood, and then that. The second state, it lacks that mid-story. One of the things that they observe differences between the states in the soil. So why are they useful? They are a tool for conservation planning. They're used widely in the West. They are slowly gaining acceptance in the East. It provides an inventory of current status. It has that reference condition, which is good for comparison, whatever it's defined as. And it should provide sustainable management alternatives. It can predict the outcomes of natural disturbances, and I think we need to adapt these to also predict climate change. It provides a roadmap for restoration, and it can support conservation initiatives, NRCS initiatives in this case, for restoring sage-grouse, is the example, sage-grouse habitat. And it does provide management interpretations how you can manage to attain a particular state of choice. So this is kind of what they do with highly managed land, with cropland here in general, is that it exists as a box outside of the state and transition model. Essentially, you can get to cropland by, tearing out the natural vegetation and get there in many systems. One of the big things here is that the pathways back won't be, it's not just one pathway back. You may not ever be able to get back to the reference state. You may only be able to get back to state 4 or state 2 and 3, something like that. So it's important to have it a little more connected than just this completely disconnected box. So we had a working group was organized by Jeff Herrick and me, a while back now, a couple years ago, where we came up with a definition of an agroecological site. Right now we're talking about it as a subset of an ecological site, but I think that over time and with enough evidence, we will be able to maybe say that it exists as a larger a spatial hierarchy, larger in higher in that spatial hierarchy. So it's a distinctive kind of land. It still has the recurring soil and climate. The difference is instead of vegetation, we're looking at distinctive ranges of soil functions based on dynamic soil properties, or those properties that change with in response to management. And so it follows that it will also respond similarly to management and natural disturbances. It still has those three things: inventory of current status, a reference condition, and gives the management alternatives. For current status, we would be measuring dynamic soil properties and infer function or ecosystem services from those properties. And to achieve that step, we need rapid tests in the field and interpretations for soil function, and that's something that we are actively working on. The reference condition is needed for comparison purposes. We identified three types: an ecological potential, which is essentially equal to that reference site or the highest amount of function that is observed for that larger ecological site. The attainable, which I mentioned before, which would be the possible function under the use of agriculture, under agricultural use. I'll talk about production groups in another slide. And then the desired level of function based on the manager, but that may also be, you know, regulations, laws may apply in some cases. So sustainable management alternatives, we will compare production groups and management systems within production groups, and then the idea of this whole system is to provide innovation or provide alternatives to allow for innovation, so that farmers can see, that various alternatives. If they want to stay with the same cropping system, they can see the different managements within it. If they want to stay with the same management and try a different cropping system, they can do that and see it all visually, which we'll get to. To do that, we need this conceptual model, which is coming up, and then we use technical assistance and education. So a production group consists of all of the current management systems that are observed within the ecological site under agricultural use for a particular cash crop or cash crop rotation. So, you know, corn on corn, soybean, wheat in the Midwest where I live currently would be probably the major ones. And it could be characterized by just a subset of the major management systems, because we can't expect someone to try to find every alternative if there's a lot of diversity. It has upper and lower bounds of function, and these will change due to changes in technology and the implementation of new technology. Those bounds will vary by that agroecological site and the larger ecological site. So here what we've done, we've got the native or naturalized state on the x-axis, and what you're going to find, this will be all the production groups along the x-axis. So these are, I guess, the larger, these should be plant community here. And we've got soil functions and ecosystem services. We've reduced the theoretical state and transition model to this one box. Okay, so this is all of the states that exist that aren't highly managed. And that's the ecological potential. Here we've identified the resource concern threshold, which is an internal NRCS threshold, and then a degradation or resilience threshold beyond which, you know, there is no return. And so here we've got the production groups. We're showing a grain rotation, forage, and we've got root crops and a vegetable rotation, just to have a wide variety here. This is showing that's the attainable for the grain. Okay. Here is attainable for forage crops. We could draw them for the root crops and the vegetable crops, and they'd be at the top of the box. Important to note that the attainable can be higher than the ecological potential of that naturalized ecological site. So here we've got the same the same things, and what I'm going to do is expand the grain rotation here. All the same lines, and now we've got a number of management systems within. And this is probably the point where managers would really get interested, where they can see all of the managements within multiple production groups, or maybe just their production group. Don't have room on the slide to show multiple production groups expanded like this. But you can see, you know, we've got from continuous no-till cover crops, and then monocrop with deep tillage, you know, as the lowest function. And on the x-axis, we're showing disturbance. This is some data that's a proof of concept from Mary Vaughn Johnson using the APEX model, and she found using annual crop production groups that they fell within to one range, just using carbon as an indicator of function, and compared with the coastal Bermuda grass. That's like a forage group. So this fits within our conceptual model, and this, of course, is model data. We are currently working on our very first pilot in Indiana with Tyler Staggs as the lead on the ground to collect real data and see how that works with the dynamic soil properties. This is just to show that, again, that those thresholds, the optimum and the thresholds will change, and even within the same production groups, their attainable thresholds will change within, you know, between agricultural sites. So we can also put a time component on here, with the x-axis being time now for one production group, so, you know, what we're calling the worst, but a degrading management system, you know, a poor, you know, we definitely have some value judgments, but certainly in terms of ecosystem functions, we've got a degrading, poor, all, there's an alternative system, and then that's the best that reaches that attainable for that production group. Some of the synergies of this approach with other things that are going on both in our agency and with external partners is this works. It's a good coupling of both ecological site work and dynamic soil property work. We would eventually like to add dynamic soil properties as something that's done for all ecological sites, so we can really put a pinpoint on those thresholds between states in all sorts of ecological sites and test whether soil properties are actually a good indicator. We'll be testing the same subsets of soils for multiple kinds of projects. The National Resources Inventory, the ARS program for CEEP, the Conservation Effects Assessment Program. We'll go on. I won't go through those. It should be applicable on a variety of land uses, especially the highly managed lands. We're going to be using map models to validate and calibrate, so that assuming things are working really well, then we should be able to use models for similar agroecosystems, so that they don't have to be tested to the same extent in all agroecosystems across the U.S. Fill in the gaps. And then we're always looking for collaborators. If anybody's interested in this, our main priorities, we're finalizing our standards within the agency, we are working on a database now that will become an interagency database. We have a memorandum of understanding between NRCS, Forest Service, and BLM. The Park Service is also very much interested, and we work with them on smaller MOUs, and we are also working with the U.S. Forest Service, and we have many university partners too. Patrick was one of them. and our plan is pretty much what I mentioned. We're running simulations. We've identified data sources, and we're just starting on the first pilot. And depending on how that goes, then we'll be spreading from there. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions?
We have one online.
Oh. And if you could read it.
Will this lead to government control of what crops farmers can grow?
Will this lead to government control of what crops can be grown by farmers? Is that right? Yeah, absolutely not. There may be certain incentives. I mean, our agency, I can only speak for our agency. We have carrots. We do not have sticks. And there may be incentives if we show that a particular production group is very advantageous in a particular agroecosystem, then we would certainly be promoting that in terms of, giving advice and that sort of thing, but never saying, no, you can't grow. I think that the markets and crop failure will handle that. Yes? Sure. So the one that was carbon, that was, restate the question. What are some of the variables that we're using to determine the ecological potential of the native or naturalized ecological site? Right now we're talking about using dynamic soil properties, and the soil properties that we're using, that sort of a minimum data set, and then saying, it should be broadened based on site characteristics. So some of the baseline ones would be total carbon, pH, bulk density, aggregate stability, and we've got a couple of biological ones that we can run in the lab too that were particulate organic matter and beta glucosidase, and I probably missed a few. There's quite a wide range that we run for our dynamic soil properties, and but then that idea of adding some. So say you're in the southeast and you might add phosphorus because phosphorus is a major concern. In the Mississippi River Valley, you'd add nitrates, perhaps, something like that. Salinity going further west.